This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand. And donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. Jonathan Goldsby, Canada Land's news editor, meticulous fordologist, co-host of Wag the Doug. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back. It's my first time on since the Yonge Street van attack. So, hi.
Jonathan, today we're going to talk about the government-funded mental hygiene campaign promoting real news, not this kind of thing we're doing here, and a master class on the art of storytelling. Your setting is Ontario during a global pandemic. Your protagonist, Doug Ford. Begin. Glad to have you back.
Glad to be back. And in preparation for the first segment in particular, I've assembled a soundboard.
I can hardly wait. This episode of Canada Land Shortcuts was brought to everyone by Martha Maznevsky, Devin Wiles, Thomas Hawk, Patrick Reed, Megan McLaren, Nicole Royal, Dean Davis, and Roland Tanner.
My name's Roland Tanner, and I'm a publisher in Burlington, Ontario. I support Canada Land because it provides news and insight I simply don't hear anywhere else, and has shown a new way for Canadian independent media to be viable. Canada Land inspired a friend of me to set up our own podcast called The 905er in July, dedicated to news and politics and discussion in Ontario's growing 905 region. It's a region of 4 million people with hardly any news coverage of its own. It's our deeply held hope that one day we too will be called Icky by Terry Molesky.
Jonathan, did you read Leslyn Lewis's piece, the failed candidate for the Conservative leadership, Leslyn Lewis? She had a piece in the National Post last week.
No, I haven't read it.
The headline read, "There is a socialist coup unfolding in Canada, and we taxpayers are funding it." Hmm. I can't resist. And since you did miss it, I'm gonna just pluck out some highlights, if I may.
I mean, I can guess what it says.
What would you guess?
What is the socialist coup? What could the socialist coup be? I don't know. Does that have to do with cancel culture?
It has nothing to do with cancel culture.
Oh, okay.
I'll take you through it a little bit here. Justin Trudeau tried to grant himself king-like powers. He has stated clearly that he wants Canada to be a post-national country. He is perceived as an evangelical for a new type of 21st century socialism, a quiet and bloodless revolution that seeks to control our lives through economic dependency. There is no need under this socialist revolution to confiscate your property. They can simply redistribute your wealth. Many Canadians rightly fear the repercussions of Trudeau transforming Canada into a cashless society. They have told me that they are afraid the Liberals will impose a social credit score similar to the one that exists in China, where people's behaviors are monitored through 5G cameras. For this reason, they also distrust the COVID Alert app. Canadians rightly fear that this authoritarian socialist agenda will be so insidious there will be no need to throw dissenters in jail because new societal protocols can be put in place, and those who fail to obey the ever-changing societal norms can simply be fined or jailed for minor infractions. It is far more paranoid, nonsensical, idiotic. I actually was intrigued by Leslyn Lewis, who you know, really outperformed a lot of people's expectations in the conservative leadership race. I did want to bring up this piece from the Post, both because, my God, but also just because it's so interesting, Jonathan, that ran last week on October 2nd in the National Post, the flagship newspaper of the largest newspaper chain in Canada. 3 days later, the Prime Minister tweets this: "Newspapers play a critical role in protecting our democracy and keeping us informed. And with this pandemic, we need credible and reliable information more than ever. So this hashtag National Newspaper Week, we're especially grateful for newspapers and the people behind them. Thank you." Now, you know, I can cherry pick some awful thing from a newspaper and then contrast that with Justin Trudeau advocating for newspapers, like not for good journalism or for the news industry, but like specifically like medium specific newspapers. And maybe that's a fallacious kind of a juxtaposition, but it does seem like, you know, the Post is very frequently running similar stuff, be it Rex Murphy, Conrad Black, that, you know, Jonathan, like, we wouldn't publish that Les Dan Lewis piece or some, you know, progressive equivalent of that, right? Like that wouldn't meet our standards. So it's interesting to me that the Prime Minister is advocating for this National Newspaper Week thing.
So I've created a soundboard of various sighs and reaction responses in preparation. That one is called Sigh 2. That's Sigh 1.
Oh, you actually did this.
There's also a...
Really?
And a...
Seriously?
And finally a...
Is that actually the argument you're making?
So this is... And that was an actual sigh. That's... I guess, okay, look, so let's look at this Trudeau tweet. You know, it's inane, it's anodyne, it's whatever, but it seems as meaningless and inoffensive as wishing people a happy Rosh Hashanah. Newspapers play a critical role in protecting our democracy and keeping us informed. I would say that's true. I don't think it literally means print newspapers, but even if it did, I would think that's a fair and accurate statement. Next sentence: and with this pandemic, we need credible and reliable information more than ever. I think we'd sure agree with that. So this hashtag National Newspaper Week, it's a stupid hashtag, whatever. But I mean, it's not like it's being used for any weird purpose, either in context or in general. So this National Newspaper Week, we're especially grateful for newspapers and the people behind them. Thank you. I mean, it depends on if you mean the people behind them. Are you talking about, you know, Paul Godfrey or Andrew McLeod, or are you talking about the journalists? But I think if you choose to be reasonably charitable and actually assume he's talking about the people who put the damn things together, then I think that's fair enough. Is National Newspaper Week a real thing? How many weeks are or are not real things? It just seems like so
no,
little.
No, I mean, why get mad
to,
about this? I hear you. I mean, you know,
it's just
you,
not a...
It's not a thing.
It's not a thing.
It's a momentary eye roll at best. Just based on Justin Trudeau's tweet, it's just some nice, pretty words about newspapers that really I actually probably agree with, right? I mean, why make this the lead topic of our program this week?
I was certainly wondering that, hence preparing the soundboard.
I was just curious why Justin Trudeau was hashtagging this National Newspaper Week. And what is this National Newspaper Week? Is this sort of an ad hoc thing? It actually, in the Canadian iteration, is run by a group called News Media Canada. News Media Canada is an organization that, by its own description of itself, is the voice of Canada's news media industry, representing hundreds of print and digital titles. Its own description of itself is a lie. They're actually a newspaper lobby group that used to be called Newspapers Canada, and most digital news sites don't want anything to do with them, largely because when they go and actually advocate for the news industry, they give priority and primacy to newspapers. And if you are running a digital news site and you're seeking subscriptions, you are in competition with newspapers. So for your representative, your lobby group, to be saying it's the newspapers that we're doing this week for, it's the newspapers that we're supporting everyone else, you're not being well represented. So this really is a newspaper lobby group calling itself a digital representative. They're handling National Newspaper Week in Canada. And when Justin Trudeau advocates for National Newspaper Week, it's not simply the Prime Minister saying, hey, newspapers are great for democracy. And even though they criticize me, and even though Les Dan Lewis thinks that I'm some kind of a tyrant, I'm going to say nice things about newspapers. In fact, he's representing the government that paid for National Newspaper Week. I asked John Hines, the president and CEO of News Media Canada, who confirmed to me that the Heritage Ministry has paid $250,000 to fund this campaign. This campaign is running throughout newspapers and elsewhere, and you can see that there's a full-page ad in a lot of newspapers across the country, and the headline reads, "We wish 2020 was fake news too. Champion the truth." Happy Newspaper Week. What's written in the negative space of this? You know, it's like we need credible and reliable information more than ever. I mean, as opposed to the other kind, right? In this scary pandemic time, we need the credible stuff. And the credible stuff is associated with the newspapers here. It's the newspapers that we're grateful for in our quest for this credible and reliable information, not the fake news. Fake news keeps getting invoked. So there's this establishment of these buckets of information, the good stuff and the bad stuff. And I don't know, where do you think we are? Which bucket do you think this puts us in? And a lot of other news organizations. As you pointed out just before we sat down here today, the CBC is also a part of this campaign. And the CBC just published an index, a local journalism finder, a list of like what local journalism outlet. Here, we're the CBC and we do local news, but we're going to support the other local news outlets that you can, you know, and you should support them too, because they do good journalism, says the CBC. And you can look up your city. If you look up Calgary, you have two choices, the Herald or the Sun. They're both post-media papers. The Sprawl, which is a great local journalism pop-up in Calgary, it's not on there. If you look up Halifax, Tim Bousquet's Halifax Examiner isn't there. If you look up Hamilton, Joey Coleman's Public Record isn't on there. If you look up Vancouver, The Breaker isn't on there. Kukukwes out in Atlantic Canada, the Indigenous news site, it's not on there. So there is a consolidation here of like the kind of mainstream information sources, and it extends from the Prime Minister's office, the Heritage Ministry, the newspaper lobby group, CBC. And some people are in it, and some people are not in it.
Jesse.
Yes.
Is that actually the argument you're making?
That is actually the argument that I'm making.
Really?
Really.
Seriously?
I'm dead serious.
This thing's coming in useful. It's very handy. Okay, so if we work backwards through this, if we work backwards through your arguments... The directory on the CBC corporate website, for whatever that distinction may be worth, there's the CBC website, there's the Radio Canada website.
What is that distinction worth to the public reader?
Well, the practical implication is no one will ever see this thing. They have the CBC Radio Canada is the corporate site. The directory strikes me as more just silly than anything else. No one will ever look at it again past today. No one will ever, maybe a few people will ever stumble across it. It probably took one person maybe 3 days to compile and post. It's whatever. Stepping back, another thing, the money they got from the government, presuming it's like their campaigns in the past years, you can just go on the, you know, the government's website and see that, you know, the money came from the Canadian Periodical Fund, which has a specific funding program, Collective Initiatives, that is to say specifically for industry advocacy. Now, I mean, yes, there you can definitely argue there's something circular, there could potentially be something circular if you look at it as the government funding industry advocacy back to the government. But if you were to at least take the ads at face value and assume that they're directed at the public at large, is it an effective ad? Is it a good ad? No, it's stupid. It's clunky. It's as clunky as pretty much any industry association advertisement. They're very seldom clever, smart, good, or even that makes sensical. Going back one more step, I mean, you've certainly spoken about, and occasionally with, News Media Canada and formerly Newspapers Canada many, many, many times on this show and on the Monday show. If it were more broadly representative of a range of types of media outlets, would you approve of it more? Clearly, you feel they're being misrepresentative, or they're misrepresenting themselves by calling them News Media Canada. But I guess I wonder if they did try to represent your interest, or if they did try to find some sort of consensus among all the various planks of the industry, do you think you would like it any more?
I mean, it's not the point whether I like it or not. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a lobby group to advocate for an industry. That's not the problem here at all, that there's a, you know, a group that's trying to do things for its members. I mean, every industry has that. There's no problem with that.
But it always seems to just rub you the wrong way, as though there's a very specific annoyance there that may or may not stem from a specific incident or wound? What is it?
And I think you've hit on something, first of all, that is a problem in my critique, which is like, you know, my interest as a business owner, you know, is something that needs to be separated. Like, that's not really what I'm trying to express here, but it's a fact. And it is, you know, like a practical conflict of interest that I can only disclose. What I'm actually getting at here has very little to do with whether they include CanadaLand or other digital news sites. What we see here are a number of kind of vectors of communication and power. They might not be exerting their power very effectively, but, you know, the Prime Minister's office is pretty powerful. The mainstream media in Canada is pretty powerful. The CBC is pretty powerful. And there's an alignment of messaging and there's an alignment of interests. And they're all sort of saying the same thing. And they are establishing categories at a time when the news media elsewhere is just like actually involved in a day-to-day struggle for, like, we kind of know from a business perspective, what news organizations need to do if they're going to make it through this, and that is they need paid subscription. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing here and what, you know, the New York Times is doing and what any news outfit in pretty much the entire Western world is doing is, like, they're fighting for subscribers. They're trying to make the best news product they can. They're trying to make the best marketing and product of that, you know, whether they, you know, have an app or put the food stuff over here. Or, like, they're really, there's a lot of innovation happening in selling news to people for the first time. But that's not what this campaign is. This campaign is a hearts and minds campaign that's kind of like, news, it matters. It might be kind of benign if it was merely things we could all agree on. But it seems to be necessary for all of this messaging to either directly or by suggestion imply that there is some menace. You know, there's something that we need newspapers to protect us from. And that thing is fake news. And to a certain extent, that's necessary. There are some scary things out there that people are very alarmed about when it comes to misinformation. We could imagine some kind of a government campaign that's like, check the source of where you're getting information from. Be careful. We don't want a more divided society. But as a kind of public health initiative, this is an incredibly blunt instrument. You know, we're getting nothing from the government about trying to distinguish really everything from CanadaLand, from The Rebel, from Vice, from BuzzFeed.
Sorry, from the government. This is from the government in what respect? You mean just in terms of Trudeau's tweet?
In terms of the government putting hundreds of millions of dollars towards some, but not all, news organizations. So by definition, there is a government designation there as to what's kosher and what's treif, what's real and what's fake. And then when they buttress that by saying, here, you know, credible information, when they're aligned in the messaging, and then the CBC takes a list from the newspaper lobby group and says, here are your local journalism outfits worthy of your support. And I think we have to ask, like, what the hell is going on and what is the larger implication? Because I don't think you can point to any other country where they're doing this, you know, and there's going to be some kind of information ecosystem tomorrow. And Canada's is going to be its own weird Galapagos Island. It's going to be very different because what's happening here is being done in concert with government. What the government is saying, and when I talk about the alignment of interests, it goes beyond the newspaper bailout, the marketing campaign, CBC support, and the bully pulpit of the Prime Minister. It goes beyond that because, of course, the newspaper lobby group and the federal government are now walking in lockstep in their efforts to tax Facebook and Google. One thing I question, Jonathan, is would the Prime Minister, in a week where the media actually was threatening his government, you know, in a week where, let's say, the SNC-Lavalin scandal was playing out in the Globe and Mail, where he actually lied and lied that this was even happening at the time, and did what Trump does, which is shoot the messenger, blame the Globe and Mail. I mean, he did it in a more polite way. But at a certain point, it became incumbent upon him not to prop up the credibility and respectability of the press, but to denigrate it. But it just so happens that right now, there's no adversarial, like serious challenge to Justin Trudeau coming from the press.
It's absolutely fair to look at this and all these components and things as indicative of all sorts of things, because they are indicative of things. I think when you're looking at the implications, that's where you're ascribing far too much momentum and even credibility to these frankly half-hearted efforts. I mean, once again, it's not like Trudeau is even speaking at an industry event, not that there are really many events these days, like it's a fucking tweet. Well, two tweets, one is in English and then again in French. The mention of fake news, once again, I think you're reading way too much into that advertisement. I mean, fake news.
Oh, it's been a consistent part of their messaging.
Oh, I know. But I mean, fake news is generally, obviously, generally speaking, is not a useful or helpful term. I mean, it has various definitions.
Well, it's obviously helpful to the newspaper industry in Canada because they've been using it as a stick to scare the public with.
People over the age of 60, you know, throw around the term fake news like some other people over the age of 60 subscribe to QAnon, and frankly, I'd rather it be fake news than QAnon. But basically, it's everything falls under this one umbrella. Any sort of grievance or mistrust or piece of paranoia or feeling of instability someone might have, especially older people, there's a very good chance they may deliver it or explain it under the umbrella of fake news. It's basically either meaningless or with so many potential meanings that it is effectively meaningless.
It might be meaningless, but it's powerful.
Is it powerful?
It's a mallet with which to beat one's ideological foes. It's all just different variations of Trump's usage of it. You're fake news. I don't even have to answer you.
I mean, it could have different potential meanings depending on the context. In the case of this, you know, poorly written ad copy, it could certainly be taken in many different ways. I choose to believe it's intended to mean bad actors and pseudo news. If you presume that these ads and this messaging is geared toward an older audience that may or may not be considering canceling their print subscriptions, maybe the implications aren't as dire as you think. When you tweet things like, you know, newspapers have sacrificed independence in partnering with the Trudeau government, that's
a factual statement. You can't be dependent on the Trudeau government and still call yourself an independent press.
What does partnering mean in that sense? And what way have newspapers partnered with the Trudeau government?
They've run a multi-year campaign lobbying and pressuring the government to establish a ongoing subsidy. They've also partnered with them in terms of basically encouraging them to go shake down Google and Facebook for an ongoing tax on those services for the benefit of the newspapers. In doing so, they're forcing the government to make determinations as to who is media and who is not media. They also are creating a situation whereby they'll have to kind of renew the government's commitment in succeeding generations as new governments emerge. They'll have to kind of, like the same way the CBC has to go back to each government and make sure that the commitment is still there. They've put themselves in a vulnerable, independent position whereby, as a point of fact, they now have skin in the game as to whether or not Trudeau gets reelected or not. I don't think that on a rank and file, reporter by reporter basis, people are making determinations about what quotes to include or what angle to take based on that. But you can't get around the fact that right now, you know, like Aaron O'Toole has said, he'll gut the CBC. He probably wouldn't keep the newspaper subsidy going. So they basically have to blind themselves. A political reporter in Canada has to pretend that they don't know what they know, which is that their job is more safe with Trudeau than without.
By the same logic, are we dependent on the Trudeau government standing because we received the Canada Emergency Wage Subsidy and there was no guarantee that a subsequent or different government would support that?
Yes. Yes, that's a complicating factor for sure. I mean, the distinction for me, and maybe it's one without a difference, is that the wage subsidy is one that any employer took just by virtue of being an employer. And I didn't have to go hat in hand to the government or to some government appointed committee and say, please, sir, designate me a real news organization. I did. That was the line in the sand, as you know, that I would not put Canada Land through. I would not subject Canada Land to a rejection or approval from the government that we have to cover. I would prefer to not be subsidized in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, a decision was made that complicates the ideological purity of my stance, but the decision that I felt I had to make to keep everybody's job intact. But yeah, I think that's a fair point to bring up. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada, and we talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. Jonathan Goldsby, if anyone knows that we note things duly, it's you. What do you have?
I'd like to duly note a piece that Shannon Carey wrote for us that we published last week that looks at the conditions that were placed on the journalist Carl Dockstader, who's from One Dish, One Mic, and has contributed to Canadaland. He was arrested and charged with mischief and for failing to obey a court order in connection with his reporting on 1492 Landback Lane, which is a Six Nations protest site and encampment at a site of a proposed housing development in southwest Ontario or southern Ontario or somewhere thereabouts. The conditions, as have been reported, included that he not go back to the site even to report, that he not have any contact with the developer or anyone connected to that site, and that he not take part in any unlawful protests or unlawful demonstrations, whatever that may mean in the context. Now, that's all shitty enough, and has certainly been looked at as like, well, that's fucked up that they would do this to anyone, and certainly to a journalist, and certainly to an Indigenous journalist reporting on an Indigenous land dispute. But what Shannon brought to my attention, what he wrote about, is that the way it would generally work is that you'd be someone would be arrested, kept overnight in jail, taken before a judge for a bail hearing. The judge then, decides on what conditions are or not. The Crown then asks for conditions, the judge makes a decision and releases the person, with certain conditions maybe, and then promising to appear at a future court date. In order to divert people from the court system and the prison system, at least at that stage, the federal government has understandably made some changes to encourage the skipping of that step so that, why keep someone in jail overnight? We could just have them sign a form prompting to show up in court. The issue with this is that, as one of the lawyers quoted in the story explains, when police get to tell people what to do, they really like to tell people what to do. And so these kinds of conditions that would most conventionally be handed out by a judge or imposed by a judge are now being decided on almost unilaterally by police, who basically present a form to a person and either they sign it and agree to whatever the police want, or they don't sign it and potentially spend some time in jail overnight or longer. In the case of Carl, these are conditions that definitely seem excessive, definitely seem outside the scope of the law. And they're conditions that if you, look at what these forms say, they're intended to ensure the safety of the victims and or witnesses to particular crimes. That is to say, it's like, if it's a domestic assault case, stay away from the person you hurt. Don't threaten any of the witnesses, things like that. And in this case, it's all the way the police have framed his conditions and the sections of the law under which they've imposed them essentially makes it seem like this housing development itself, this construction site, is the victim. And that is really effed up, and it is such a clear way, it is such a clear example of how property rights are weighed against civil liberties.
Duly noted. I want to duly note an update to a story from out east over in Digby, Nova Scotia. Listeners will remember I talked to Trina Roach before about this moderate livelihood lobster fishery, where Mi'kmaq fishermen have actually had the right for many years to go out and earn a living. A moderate living is actually how it's defined, fishing for lobster, but have been just waiting for that to be ratified and formalized. And finally, they said, fuck it, we're just going to do it. Mm-hmm. And there's been opposition from the local grand scale commercial lobster fishery, where they've been intimidating the customers, intimidating the Mi'kmaq fishermen. People recall the story. The update is that they burned a boat.
They burned a big Mi'kmaq boat?
They did.
Holy shit.
Yeah. CBC and others have reported that a Mi'kmaq fishing vessel damaged in suspicious fire overnight this week. It was set ablaze. It was not the boat that this particular fisherman uses in the in this part of the season. He's still able to go out, but it's a boat worth, you know, $40,000 to him. And there's an escalation of these tensions. This is, you know, I think very clearly linked to this conflict. And I don't think people should take their eyes off of it. So that's what I wanted to point out today.
Yeah. Thank you for drawing my attention to that. One of these things that amid so many fucking things going on everywhere all the time.
Yeah.
I fear I would have missed that. Duly noted.
Yesterday, the Associate Medical Officer of Health said she recommended people stick only to their immediate family for Thanksgiving dinner. You just a few minutes ago said stick to the limit of 10 people. That is mixed messaging, is it not? And it's confusing people out there. So which one is it? Because, you know, I live in a small home with under 10, but you're saying I could have 10.
If you play, sorry, Cynthia, but if you...
Only the people I live with.
So if you play it back, I said stick within your household. Your household, that's what I said, so... stick within 10 people. You know, what we're asking, try to stay within the family. If you're going over, and I understand there's a lot of single people out there, if they have a family they're close to, please wear a mask, keep social distance.
So that was about as clear as mud. Doug Ford telling everybody what they should be doing on Thanksgiving, and then misremembering his own advice. And then James Waddy of the CBC pointing out that fact with a nifty little rewind feature that would be nice to have, as you pointed out.
Oh, my God. I want to have whatever that program is that lets him instantly clip live press conferences and add a special rewind effect. But one of the remarkable, there's endless ways to analyze COVID and the government responses to it. But one of the things I've been really fascinated by in the past, it's really picked up in the past week or so, is the way that people have been looking at the opacity of the government messaging in Ontario. You know, a term that, it's been used before in news, in discussing the news and discussing all sorts of things. And we regrettably first heard it last week, you know, in the coverage of the U.S. election debate, was a bias towards coherence, that the news media and journalists almost necessarily have a bias towards coherence, and that if you're writing an article or packaging a news story, or regardless of the medium, chances are if you're taking a quote, you're going to take a quote that, at least by itself, sounds coherent and makes enough sense. It says something. But when you look at these things, when you look at these same lines, or just look at these answers that politicians will give to straightforward questions in their entirety, it's really remarkable. And so, which is once again not a new thing, but in the past week particularly,
like, we make them coherent when they're incoherent.
Exactly. And in the past week in particular, and one of the reason why we're talking about this is that people have been clipping those videos of Doug Ford and other public officials and even transcribing their full responses so that you can see what they're saying. Really, they're saying everything at once, or they're saying nothing at all, and probably everything and nothing at the same time. So yesterday, the anchor at CTV News Ottawa asked a question in the press conference. It wasn't the most straightforward question, but basically he said, you know, what do you say to people who are just flat out confused and they don't know what to do and they're trying to do the right thing and they're very, very worried about where Ontario is going in terms of, you know, basic in terms of like what is allowed, what isn't allowed, what contact should people have with other people, what contact should they not have. And Doug Ford, you know, said he was being pretty clear and offering a pretty clear and direct answer. If you transcribe it, it's 400 words and with a bunch of tangents that basically contradicts itself and wraps itself inside out several times over. And it's one thing if you hear him say it, but I'm going to read it until Jesse interrupts me to tell me to stop. Well, I'm being very frank. I'm hearing the total opposite. We're flattening the curve, we're putting the protocols in, and I'm just going to compare restaurants to going over and seeing your loved ones. And this is going to be about as clear as I can for Thanksgiving. You know what we're asking? Try to stay within the family. If you're going over, and I understand there's a lot of single people out there, if they have family or they're close to, please wear a mask, keep social distance. And regarding restaurants, that's like apples and bananas. When you go into a restaurant, they're taking everyone's name. You have six at a table. They have dividers. They have protocols in place, and the rest of the people in the restaurant you don't know. And that's the difference. At a family, you know the people. Please, it's very simple. There's rules and there's guidelines. The rules are very clear. 10 indoors, 25 outdoors. I would really, really discourage people from having 25 people, even if it's outdoors. Stick within 10 people. And folks, we went through this so much together. We can get through this. This is going to make or break it this Thanksgiving. We see the numbers slowly flattening. They still are high, but I've seen it decline yesterday. The testing is up to 42,000, a record, and I don't know how Ontario Health CEO Matt Anderson does it. I know I've said he's a champion, but he is a champion. He's moving forward with a record number. We're going to increase the numbers, even with the struggles that we've had with getting the lab technicians and getting the reagent, but he's pulled a rabbit out of his hat somehow. The guy is unbelievable. So he's going to continue doing that, and we'll get through this. And Thanksgiving is going to make it or break it. Just please hang in there. You know I have a big family. And I told my wife, Carla, I said, you know, and she knows, we have no more than 10. And simple as that. And that's what we're going to obey by as well. And when it comes to having everyone over, your aunts and uncles, you know, hang off on the hugging and the kissing and everything else. I just want to make through it the Thanksgiving here. But we see a little bit of the flattening right now, but we need to bring the numbers down still. So that's about as clear as I can be on that. So there shouldn't be any confusion.
I think I see what you're getting at, Jonathan. There's a lot of room for confusion in that. And we would hope for a lot more clarity from a politician, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm going to pivot here. I think I actually need to challenge your premise to some extent.
Sure.
I think it's... It reminds me of the Sarah Palin, candidacy when she was a laughingstock, and the way that she spoke was seized upon, and not just by Tina Fey, but everybody was making fun of her. And I can't remember who it was, but the point was made like, you fucking snobs, real people don't talk in the super artificial and, completely pre-written way and careful language and lawyered and gone through PR and messaging that many politicians do. And Sarah Palin connects with people who have no trouble figuring out what she's trying to say. In a sense, there's a premonition there of everything awful that happened after that, how real people talk and the way that real people communicate and get themselves across. But I felt this often with Trump, where the establishment media and comics and critics, you can have a field day making fun of the way that this guy expresses himself. But he is a masterful communicator. And the people who he's speaking to know exactly what he means. And we're doing no one any favors by pretending that that's not true, by pretending that he's just some doofus idiot. These people are improvisatory. Their whole power, I think, derives from the fact that they're not like writing down sentences saying, like, let's stick to our message. What I say is very important. I'm an elected official. I have a lot of power. People read into my words. I don't want to make mistakes. Let me just stick to the script. But they are, so you're going to get mistakes and misstatements, but there is meaning within that.
There's meaning within that, but yes, like everything you're saying is absolutely true and fair as part of a discussion of political communication. But I think that is precisely the problem here, is it's very well established fact in all kinds of medical and public health literature that it is crucial in the context of a public health crisis to have clear and consistent messaging, ideally stuff that does not come from politicians or in which politicians don't take the lead, so that you're not getting into these things. As political communications, yeah, this is fine. But this is precisely why there should be clear, consistent direction, because in a public health crisis, that is crucial. If he wants to answer to give a debate answer like this, and he does, like, fine, good. That's what he does. That's how he connects with people. That's cool. But in this,
this is life or death stuff. I agree with you here. I just you are a person who, as a journalist, is very meticulous with your words. You're also quite expansive with your words, and the need for concision and summary. I don't know. Doug Ford wasn't exactly concise there.
No, it's 400 words.
I think that we can be faulted as much as we can be praised for trying to derive meaning. It is a journalist's job to listen to a word salad like Doug Ford emitted there and try to figure out what the hell is he talking about. And I can kind of figure out what he's talking about. He's like, look, the rules are you can have 25 people outdoors, but I don't recommend it. You know, he contradicted himself with a 10-person thing because he seemed to be confused as to whether or not that's the members of your family or a 10-person bubble, and misremembered that he had, that he was, you know, contradicting himself on that. And, you know, Theresa Tam can be like her communication's been terrible.
Public health officials can often have this the same, like, yeah, they've not been consistently great either. I mean, this is not unique. Like, all kinds of people can be poor communicators. I think I should be clear on that. But if you're going to take the lead on these things and you're going to try to be the face of it and the figurehead, whether you're a public health official or a politician, you should have your act together and not have to give contradictory answers.
I think you brought an interesting media critique in this idea of, basically a bias towards things making sense, which, you know, on the flip side of that is like we're trying to find the meaning. I was a bit more compelled by a different bias the media has. And it is a Doug Ford issue to, you know, and apologies to the rest of the country right now, but we have a bias towards storytelling. We have a bias towards building up characters and narrative. And that bias is understood by political operators. So when Doug Ford earlier in the pandemic releases this like a cheesecake video, I know that sounds disgusting, a Doug Ford cheesecake video. It was literally Doug Ford making cheesecake, cooking with Doug, with his famous cheesecake recipe, which I have to tell you, it was a very basic, like, fucking Betty Crocker cheesecake recipe. Box, there's nothing special about that cheesecake. It was reported as news by CTV. Toronto Star had a story about it where they're like, oh, let's recreate his cheesecake. It was a bit salty, the story, not the cheesecake. Mm. But that was news that Doug Ford, and it was consistent with Doug Ford building himself up as a character, like meet the kinder, gentler Doug Ford who has found his inner leader, who is not as combative, who has risen to the occasion, who's found a way to be classy and human under the pandemic. And really, who would have thunk it? He's the leader that Ontario needs and we're handling this really well. That was a narrative that pretty much got like across the spectrum buy-in from, it wasn't the public who were clamoring for that. It was the media, like not just selling that to the public, but taking it from Ford and selling it to the public. And lo and behold, here we are where, like, as a news consumer, I have really one question for this government, which is, why do we not have rapid testing? You had months to prepare for this and all the money in the world. We know that that's how things can be dealt with. We know from the rest of the world that that's the best tool we have to avoid a full societal shutdown. And in terms of accountability journalism, that's all I want. Journalists, I want clarity on public health advice and rules. I want to know what's the advice, what are the rules. I don't want any confusion about that. He's fucked that up. And I want to know what's going on with rapid testing. When are we going to get it? Why don't we have it yet? I don't need to see his cheesecake recipe. So this bias we have towards warm and fuzzy stories and heroes is the bias that I find most concerning.
The Star just today had a story, or ran online yesterday, I think it was in today's paper, I'm not going to roll back. Doug Ford claims COVID-19 has changed his partisan outlook. The word claim, I appreciate the use of the word claims in the headline, but, I mean, so this is reporting a Zoom event for Ryerson University, in which he basically claims to be a kinder, gentler politician who's evolved. He's quoted as saying, this is the way I'm going to be. I'm going to be this way moving forward. I'm not going to roll back, the premier said, pointing to his close working relationship with Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland, as well as other premiers and municipal leaders. And it's true, certainly, that he's, generally speaking, less of a pugilistic asshole than he had been previously. But it also conveniently ignores the fact that, like, 5 hours before that Ryerson event, he was back to being a pugilistic asshole in the legislature. The leader of the opposition, Andrea Horvath, asked him, you know, why are you so reluctant to impose these measures that public health agencies in Toronto and Ottawa are begging for? He basically would go back to, you know, yelling at, like, have you ever run a business?
Have you ever run a business?
Have you ever had to meet a payroll?
Have you ever had to meet a payroll?
You know, the answer is no, because you've been on the public dole for the last 20 years down here.
That's the reason.
I mean, he's been a politician the past 7 or 10 years. Like, it's just like, he hasn't changed.
No one is more aware of this than the reporters who cover him day in and day out. So do we run with that narrative?
I'm just more surprised that was that particular story was framed, because it does seem to still be hoping against hope that there is some meaningful evolution. Whereas, I mean, it's pretty clear that it's been incremental at best. Just for the record, and the public health advice is going to be a bit different everywhere, but Toronto Public Health is urging residents to limit their Thanksgiving celebrations to, quote, only the people you live with, in the same household, under the same roof. And for those who live alone, they say, the safest option is to join others virtually. That's consistent with the advice being given out by the City of Ottawa as well. I just wanted to clarify that.
That is our shortcuts for today. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you.
You can email me about it at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read everything you send. We're on Twitter at CanadaLand. Jonathan, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter at Goldspeed, or I guess on and around CanadaLand.
Our website is CanadaLandShow.com. This episode is produced by Tiffany Lamb. Our managing editor is Andrea Schmidt. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like what we do and you want to receive ad-free versions of our podcasts, just click on the link in your show notes or go to CanadaLandShow.com/join. It'll just take a second. It's how we do this.